I'm Afua Hirsch.
I'm Peter Frankopan.
And in our podcast, Legacy, we explore the lives of some of the biggest characters in history.
This season, we're exploring the life of Cleopatra.
An iconic life full of romances, sieges, and tragedy. But who was the real Cleopatra? It feels like her story's been told by others with their own agenda for centuries.
But her legacy is enduring, and so we're going to dive into how her story has evolved all the way up to today.
I am so excited to talk about Cleopatra, Peter.
Love Cleopatra.
She is an icon.
She's the most famous woman in antiquity. It's got to be up there with the most famous woman of all time.
But I think there's a huge gap between how familiar people are with the idea of her compared to what they actually know about her life and character.
So for pyramids, Cleopatra and Cleopatra's nose.
Follow Legacy now wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can binge entire seasons early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. What a treat it is today. We're going to be talking about the Champagne Riots, two words you don't often hear juxtaposed unless you're talking about the university careers of notable recent British prime ministers. The Champagne Riots took place in Champagne. It's a fascinating story about big wine. Big wine in France 100 years ago. Bad harvest, climate change, invasive species, pandemic. I mean, you name it. It's all here, everybody. It's all here. And it's fascinating stuff. And I'm pleased to say that I've got on the podcast Rebecca Gibb. She is, she's making waves in the UK. She's a wine journalist, wine critic. She's, in fact, a master of wine, which, I mean, just sounds so cool. She's won the Bollinger Medal in recognition of outstanding tasting ability. It's so cool. And she's incredibly engaging. I was on TV with her the other day. She said to me, her particular field of expertise is these Champagne Riots. I said, get on the podcast ASAP. And that's what we did. So we had this great chat. Enjoy. It was filmed. It's going to be, this will be eventually, it'll be a film on History Hit TV like so many others. We've got hundreds of films on there. If you use the code POD6, P-O-D-6, you get 6 weeks free access to History Hit TV. Check it out. If you don't like it, don't subscribe. But if you do, join us. Join us. Become subscribers. We have got feature-length documentary on there. The Air War in the Second World War. Lots of extraordinary historians there. Hopefully a more in-depth look at but the Bomber War on these important anniversaries, 75 years since some of the most enormous bombing raids of the Second World War. So please, please go and check that out. We've also, from now on, we've got all of the old podcasts from 2015 and 2016 are now on historyhit.tv exclusively. So you get the app from the App Store, you download the app, you subscribe, and you can listen to all our old episodes, which are now themselves things of history, I suppose. So, in the meantime, everyone, here is Rebecca Gibb. Enjoy. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. You asked nicely.
Yeah, I did ask nicely. Repeatedly. I've been trying to get on for ages.
I know, you're a busy man, and I'm a busy lady.
So, champagne, was it always the luxury brand of alcoholic grape juice?
Well, it hasn't actually always been sparkling until the sort of the late 17th century, early 18th. It was still very much a still wine. It's amazing to hear that most of the wines were actually red rather than white.
So champagne was a red flat wine.
Yeah, and you can still get red flat wine from Champagne. Bollinger makes one. There's a village called Bouzy, which specialises in Rouge, or Bouzy Rouge. I know, you couldn't think of a better name, could you? So it wasn't sparkling until maybe early 18th century, and they didn't really have a grasp over how it was becoming sparkling at that point. It isn't until winemaking technology comes along in the 19th century that we actually get a hold on what makes champagne sparkling and what it would look like today.
So people in the 18th century, when you get like characters in Dickens, they drink champagne. It's just this weird fizzy wine that's coming out, and no one quite knows why it's fizzy.
Well, there isn't a lot of scientific knowledge around wine until the likes of Lavoisier and Chaptal and Pasteur come along. Until then, it's really what they've been doing before. What did their fathers do? What did other monks do? It really was just a case of observation.
How cool.
Mm.
So champagne, when did it become the sort of the poshest version of wine?
Well, actually, in Restoration London, there was an exile called Charles de Saint-Evremond, who is buried in Poets Corner in Westminster. He comes along to Restoration England and he introduces champagne to the royal court. And that's when its first association really comes with luxury. In the early 1800s, the czars and princes were starting to drink it, but there wasn't a lot of it going around at that time. I think there's some statistics that say in about the early 1800s, there's probably around 300,000 bottles of sparkling champagne being made. So there's not a lot of it going around. There's lots of people that want to drink it, so it necessarily has a high price. So really it is only reserved for high society at that time.
And can other parts of France make fizzy wine today?
Anyone can make fizzy wine in the same way as champagne. You can use the champagne method, which means that you do a second fermentation in the bottle. So fermentation is sugar plus yeast, makes alcohol and carbon dioxide. So you do your first fermentation to make a still base wine, and then you put it into a bottle, you add some sugar, you add some yeast. Byproducts are carbon dioxide and alcohol, and the carbon dioxide is trapped in the bottle, and that's where you get the sparkle from. So it's a bottle fermented sparkling wine. You can do that anywhere, but you can only call it champagne if it is from the area that is champagne. And that was one of the major reasons for the riots in 1911, which we'll talk, I'm sure we're going to talk about at some point.
Tell me about these riots. That's why I wanted to talk to you. What on earth is going on with the champagne riots?
Well, obviously, champagne is associated with luxury. It has been, as I say, since sort of Restoration England. And yet, there is great poverty in the Champagne region in the early 1900s. There's lots of factors involved in the Champagne riots. But really, the catalyst for the riots that take place in spring 1911 is that people have basically got no money. Bread prices are skyrocketing, and they had a total failure of a harvest in September 1910, which means they've got no grapes to sell. Times are tough. So that's the catalyst, but trouble has been fermenting in Champagne for at least 20 years before the riots took place.
Why? What's wrong with Champagne?
What's wrong with France for the French wine industry in the late 19th century is one of the big problems that the country faces at this time is a thing called phylloxera. Phylloxera is an aphid, and it goes around nibbling on the roots of vines. It eats the sap, and it also, when it goes on its merry way, leaves wounds behind which any disease can therefore access. It comes from America, and in 1862, a vine grower in a village just north of Avignon receives a present from an American friend. He receives some vines. It doesn't go so well then. Within 2 years of him planting these vines, he notices these galls on the leaves, on the vines. The vines are dying. Several miles away, the same thing is happening. So this is happening early 1860s. By 1900, 2.5 million hectares of vines in France have been uprooted because phylloxera has basically ravaged France's vineyards. People use various methods to try and cure it, but they're really, you can't just deal with the symptoms. People are injecting a nerve poison, carbon disulfide, into the soil in an attempt to prevent its spread. It works for a while. It's not so effective. The French government also offers a 20,000 franc reward for a cure, and there are some fanciful cures offered up, including a marching band playing in the vines. And there's also burying a live toad and another such useless ideas. But what they had to really do was they had to graft their vines onto the rootstock of an American vine, and that is the only cure for phylloxera.
Are you telling me that all the French vines in France today are descended from American vines?
I am telling you that all the vines across the world that are Vitis vinifera, that are international, like Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay, they are all grafted onto the rootstock of an American vine. Is that big news for you?
Yeah. I mean, my French brother, my half-brother is French, really, and he's got a heart attack when he hears that. Sorry, Matt.
Yeah, it's true. But if it wasn't for American, what known as American rootstocks, there would be no French wine industry today.
Really?
Yeah.
So that process is now going on in the late 19th century.
Yeah.
Sounds expensive.
Join us this month on Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Matt Lewis.
And I'm Eleanor Yonaga. This April, dive into our special mini-series.
With the help of leading experts, we're tracing the foundations of England by exploring the country's most powerful Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
We'll be looking at Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex, as well as the rulers and their councils who helped shape a nation.
Make sure to get every episode by listening and following Gone Medieval from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's very expensive. It's not necessarily the cost of the wood to create the new vine. It's actually the cost of uprooting your entire vineyard and then replanting it. If you want to replant a vineyard, you have to wait between 3 and 5 years for a crop.
Oh my goodness.
So there are all these vignerons having to rip out their vines and then they're having to replant at great expense. They haven't really got any life savings left. They don't have any assistance from the government to do this. And then on top of that, in the early 1900s, there are crop failures through mildew, there's lots of rain, there's rot. People aren't able to harvest. Then this is one of the great problems for Champagne and the rest of the country in 1910, that they've got a string of failed harvests on top of having to replant, huge financial problems.
And are most grape producers in this period, they kind of artisanal who then give their grapes to the local vineyard? I mean, so they're not, they're smallholders, are they?
Champagne has a unique structure in that it's very fragmented, and people who own vineyard parcels own very small vineyard parcels, and they don't have the infrastructure to produce the wine. So that's why you've got the likes of Merton Chandon or Louis Roederer, they're champagne houses. They don't own enough vineyards today, even today, to fulfill all their needs to make their wine. So what happens is there are grape growers and there are wine producers in Champagne. And the grape growers are selling their grapes to these big houses on Négociant. And if they haven't got any grapes to sell, what are you gonna do? The Champagne houses, however, have got reserve stocks from previous vintages, so they're able to draw on these reserves in difficult times. So they're not as highly affected.
And you've got First War on the horizon, which is not easy in Champagne either. But anyway, so let's talk about, when are the riots?
So the riots start to occur in the first 3-4 months of 1911.
Oh, 1911, turbulent year.
And the harvest has failed in September 1910. They harvested around 2% of what they would do on average. 1907 was a terrible harvest. 1908 was a terrible harvest. 1909 was a very small harvest, although the quality was good. And then you get this absolute cataclysmic harvest in 1910. So no one's got any grapes to sell. And yet this is the time when champagne sales are at record highs. People are drinking a lot of champagne by now. Champagne sales almost double between 1890 and 1910. So you've got 300,000 bottles being sold in the 1800s to these czars and princes, 39 million bottles by 1909. But there are no grapes. So where's all the wine coming from? It's not coming from the Marne department or the Aube department, which is the traditional heartland of champagne production.
So all your big champagne producers are buying in the grapes from elsewhere?
The unscrupulous ones are, yes. They are buying in grapes from the Languedoc, thank you to the railways in the 19th century, and also lots of the wines coming from the Loire Valley. They are being trucked in by rail to Epinay station, and then they're going into the cellars of these Négociants, and they're coming out sparkling and with a champagne label on it. People are pissed off. And people therefore blame lots of the Négociants for depressing grape prices. Supply and demand economics suggests that if your sales are at record highs and your grape harvest is at a record low, the price for grapes is going to necessarily be high. However, that doesn't work when...
You can cheat. And so all of these grape growers in Champagne take matters in their own hands?
Yes, they do. Things come to a head in April 1911. Things have been boiling in the first few months of 1911. There are isolated incidents of villagers going into some of the merchants' houses and basically emptying casks down the street, of glass bottles being strewn all around the village. And obviously nobody was saying anything. The police would arrive and everyone would be back in their houses. But things come to a head in April 1911. The government have been moderately involved in coming up with some regulations to prevent fraud from happening. But they've been dilly-dallying and they haven't been implementing these laws. And the producers are just sick of it. And so in April 1911, they take to the streets and they take to the vineyards. And in the village of Ailly, which is where Bollinger is based, for example, there are barricades put up. There are champagne houses burnt to the ground. And the government, by that time, has already brought in troops. So there are troops stationed in Champagne to try and maintain peace. They've seen that trouble is fermenting since the 1910 harvest failed, and they are trying to keep cap on it. But there are too many vignerons. And in April 1911, they do around the equivalent of about £1 million worth of damage to various champagne houses, and there are about 40,000 vines that are trampled or burnt or raised. It's quite interesting to know that a lot of those vines that were damaged belonged to the unscrupulous merchants. There is a book called The Livre Noir des Assassins. So basically an anonymous pamphlet has been produced in early 1911 that lists down all those producers who are thought to be acting fraudulently. And it's interesting to know that the champagne houses that were targeted in these attacks were the ones listed in this book.
Okay, so it's action, quite directed action at these houses. What is the effect? Does the government and the troops and they crack down presumably not on the fraudsters but on the people rioting?
Absolutely, and in the town of Epinay on the same day, the cavalry charges at another protest, and villagers on the street are opening their doors for people to escape the sabres that are being swung at them. But that because of the violence incited on these days in April, a lot of people turn against the vignerons. They didn't like the violence. One of the local cinema owners, he went out into the street to film what was happening, to then show it in his cinema, in his theatre. And it actually turns out that the police then seize this film and use it almost as CCTV. And they arrest 150 people that they see on this film. As a result, arrests are made and then trials take place in a mining town an hour to the north of Epinay, in Douai. There's a trial of around 46 people. But the jurors are all miners, and they take pity on the vignerons. They're experiencing similar hardship at this time, and there are only a few that are actually convicted.
What is the long-term impact of these riots?
It's interesting to note that tensions that were fermenting then start to go on a simmer after the riots. The government has decided that it will create a zone where you can only make champagne, and it's now going to implement those measures.
So the riots worked?
In a way, yes, the riots kind of worked. The government agrees to implement the measures around the zone of Champagne. So now there is an embryonic, what we call an appellation. They also have an area about 100 kilometres to the south called the Aube, who want to be part of Champagne. And this was part of the tensions. The Marne wanted just to be Champagne, but the Aube, which is where, near Troyes, which is the historical centre of the Champagne region, they also want to be part of Champagne for reasons of history. And so that what the government does, it creates, the Marne is the most prestigious Champagne zone, but you can also create Champagne as a deuxième, a second zone in the Aube. It's a bit of fudging, but it works for now. These riots are happening in April, and by May and June, the vines are flowering again. It's time to get back into the vineyards for these vignerons to get ready for the next harvest, which turns out to be bountiful. And those economic issues are less pressing once they have grapes to sell.
Did everything go back to the way it was before, or were there changes in the relationships between the grape growers and champagne houses? Did they forgive them?
The big champagne houses, the big famous names, tended not to be the ones that were committing fraud. The tension between the grower and the houses persists to this day. Because the prices of the grapes each year are decided. And there's always, the houses want them cheaper and the growers want them to be more expensive. And there's that tension, that structural tension within Champagne, which continues to this day.
As people around the world want to drink champagne, there's enough grapes, are they? They've managed to produce more and more grapes, I guess. Or do they sneak them in?
They do not sneak them in. However, in 2008, when champagne sales were at a record high, funnily enough, the INAO, which is the legal body for appellations in France, they announced that they were going to do a review of the Champagne area and that they were looking at increasing the vineyard area by about 1,000 hectares. Its timing was impeccable, shall we say. They're still doing the analysis of the sites, but should you be on the right side of the border, your land will be around, you know, €1 million a hectare. If you land the wrong side of the border, you might be selling your land for about €5,000 a hectare.
Wait, 5,000?
Well, if you can't plant vines in Champagne, you can plant cereals.
That's the difference, €1 million versus 5,000. Wow.
If you're in a Grand Cru vineyard in Champagne, you're going to be paying at least €2 million a hectare.
Hectare is not very big. It's only a matter of time before we're sitting here and you're telling me that the French have decided that there's a little area of southern China that they're going to allow to be grown champagne. I can see it. Well, thank you so much. That was what a weird and wonderful story into an industry that we all think we know about. Is your book just about champagne?
Okay, so I'm going to be writing a book about the history of wine fraud, and I'm currently about 20,000 words deep into it. I'm working with my agent on that, and it should be ready to submit to publishers by April, fingers crossed. And I hope that it would be out in maybe 18 months to 2 years, so perhaps I'll come back here and chat to you about more dodgy dealings in the wine industry.
I think we have the history on our shoulders.
Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favor to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money. Makes sense. But if you could just do me a favor, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there, law of the jungle out there, and I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Hold up.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.